Graham Hancock with us, and of course, the interactive portion of the program, your phone calls, when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Graham, this cataclysm that occurred and wiped out just about the whole planet, do you think it could have been a cycle? I mean, does it happen and it just comes around and around like some people talk about a Planet X?
I do think it's cyclical. I'm glad you've raised that. When we were talking in the last half hour about the global cataclysm and about the evidence that that I reviewed and reported in Fingerprints of the Gods in 95, there's a couple of other researchers I want to mention who have a bearing on what you've asked just now, who did incredibly important work. First of all, Rand and Rose Flemmath, who wrote a book, a remarkable book called When the Sky Fell, that was also published in 1995, and which looked at a phenomenon that I reported in Fingerprints of the Gods called Earth Crust Displacement. And that takes us back to the work of an earlier researcher, Charles Hapgood, who was professor of the history of science, who proposed that the whole crust of the Earth may sometimes move around the mantle of the Earth, may slip, rather like the loose skin of an orange might slip around the fruit, and in so doing, move the poles from one position into another. So that in that view, an ice age is simply the place where the pole is at that particular time, the north and the south pole, where ice accumulates, but then moves and slips into warmer zones. So, and they proposed that this was a cyclical process, and suggested a really novel idea that that Antarctica, this was suggested by Rand and Rose Flemmath, that Antarctica might have been the place which was the heartland of a lost civilization. And then we need to go back to another researcher, very little known in the English-speaking world, called Flavio Barbiero, who, as early as the 1970s, had proposed Antarctica as the location of a lost civilization in an Italian book, the translation of which is roughly A Civilization Under the Ice. And I have an article by Flavio Barbiero, which he published on my website in 2006. It's in the articles page of my website, grahamhancock.com, which goes into his whole thesis. And this is where it gets really interesting, because what he is suggesting is that to set in motion the process of Earth crust displacement, and these suggestions go back to the 1970s in his case, to set that in motion, you need some kind of impact, some kind of momentum striking the Earth. And he suggests that a cometary or asteroid impact occurring cyclically may be involved in these sudden instantaneous pole shifts. His article is called On the Possibility of Instantaneous Shifts of the Poles. And if you just search Flavio Barbiero, B-A-R-B-I-E-R-O, on my articles page on my website, you'll find that article. And that's where we now connect with the new evidence for a comet that hit the Earth 12,900 years ago. Did that set in motion a displacement of the crust? Was that the impact that made the which would make it a truly gigantic and horrendous cataclysm? And that's again a possibility now that we have this new evidence of the cometary impact I'll be investigating. Now, here's the thing: comets are very interesting and mysterious objects, and there are comets that are called long period comets, which may cycle around the solar system on orbits that could be 12,000 or more years long. And the alarming prospect is this: we know a comet hit the Earth 12,900 years ago. We know that at any rate that fragments of it hit the Earth. I don't want to be a doomsayer, and I do not go around the world, you know, wearing that sandwich board saying that the end of the world is nigh. But let's consider
the rapture is near, right?
Yeah, that's not me. I don't believe that, and I believe we should project positive thoughts onto the universe, and that we as human beings should behave with love and concern for one another, and that's what we will then attract towards ourselves. But we should also be alert to dangers. And it may just be the case that fragments of that original comet that hit the Earth 12,900 years ago are still in orbit. And if it's a long-period comet, then what goes around comes around. They could be coming back again. And we've seen an unusual increase in mysterious impacts on the Earth, as though there's a kind of cloud of small objects flying through the solar system. possibly amongst them larger objects. Comets are not always visible at first. It's not until they outgas as they approach the sun that we start to see the characteristic cometary tail. And it's possible that huge objects are flying through our solar system that we're just not aware of at the moment that may be coming towards us. We know of one comet which has already been spotted and which is reportedly going to be the brightest object in the sky in December.
Comet Ison
in December 2013. And that's weird, you know, because that's like exactly just 1 year after the end of the Mayan calendar. And you have to wonder whether the Mayans, who inherited an ancient star watching tradition, were in fact trying to pass down some kind of warning, some kind of suggestion. I don't think that the end of the world is nigh, but I think we should be alert to the dangers from the skies, and perhaps NASA should be spending more of its resources on tracking near-Earth objects, so-called Apollo objects like asteroids, which is truly terrifying when you look at their orbits and the way that they crisscross the orbit of the Earth, and to considering the danger of comets coming around, because part of the story that I told in Fingerprints of the Gods, originally when that book was published, the subtitle was A Quest for the Beginning and the End, that there was a sense of a warning coming down from the past, not merely telling us that something bad happened to us between 12,000 and 13,000 years ago, but that something is of a cyclical nature, that it could come back again. And I would just like to see more research and energy devoted to considering this, because we have a precious and beautiful gift from the universe in this planet Earth, where we have the opportunity to live out and fulfill our lives as human beings. And it's our responsibility to look after it and take care of it. And that involves considering the very real danger of large objects impacting with the Earth from outer space. And that danger should not be underplayed. We know that it's happened in the past. We know it happened 12,900 years ago. We know that the extinction of the dinosaurs was almost certainly connected to such an event. And we should not be complacent. And we should listen to the wisdom of the past and see what it has to tell us.
Okay, let's go to the phones now. Skype is with us, Nick in Richmond, Virginia. Nick, go ahead.
Hi, how are you guys doing? I am such a huge fan of the show.
Well, thank you, Nick.
I would love to ask Graham if you knew about the Mount Toba eruption that was supposed to have happened about 75,000 years ago.
Sure. I do know about Mount Toba.
Population to like 5,000 people.
Yeah, in fact, it's thought that our ancestors may have been put through a kind of evolutionary funnel at that point. It may have been reduced to even just 2,000 individuals.
Right. That would reduce our, like, that's why, you know, we've all got hair on top of our heads, like, you know, like all the genetic, like, I guess, pool at that point would have been reduced to almost nothing. That's why we're all so very similar.
Yeah, absolutely, and indeed we all are incredibly similar. It's one of the reasons why I just don't understand this division that's in the world today, because we are all one family. Doesn't matter what country we happen to have been born on, or minor differences in skin color or appearance, whether at the genetic level we're all, you know, absolutely identical, and we should be supporting and nurturing and valuing one another rather than dividing and hating and steering one another. And Mount Toba was a fascinating event, rather like this cometary impact. It did put up a great plume of dust into the upper atmosphere, put the Earth into a deep freeze, led to massive extinctions. And sometimes, it's also worth pointing out that periods of great seismic activity are associated with cometary impacts. When you get a massive impact with the Earth, this can set off seismic activity all around the globe and multiply the problem. So that is an intriguing period, and it's well documented, and the human race goes down to just 2,000 individuals and then multiplies again from there. So this tells us we are vulnerable. We are not immune, you know. We live in a universe in which there is a certain random factor at work, and we need to pay attention to that.
All right, let's go to AJ in Pompano Beach, Florida. Welcome to the program, AJ.
Thank you, George. Great to be on. I was just wondering, it's been theorized that the Black Sea used to be a giant valley, and that the one end pretty much just gave way, mm-hmm. and it filled up with water, and that might have lowered the entire sea level, maybe 200 to 300 feet, and they have found a pyramid off the coast of Japan in approximately 300 feet of water. I was wondering what your thoughts on that are, if you think maybe before the Black Sea entryway gave way, if maybe that might be one of the areas that you were talking about as far as monument that was.
Thank you for your question. I've actually dived on that pyramid off Japan. In fact, between 1997 and 2003, I put in well over 1,000 scuba dives all around the world, researching a book called Underworld, of which 200 were off the coast of Japan. And there is an extraordinary complex of submerged ruins off the island of Yonaguni, in the most southwestern part of Japan, and off the island of Okinawa, particularly off an island called Akajima, where there's a gigantic stone circle. These monuments are not 300 feet underwater. They're just somewhat over 100 feet underwater. That stone circle off Okinawa is 110 feet underwater, and the base of the terraced structure at Yonaguni that many refer to as a pyramid is also about 110 feet underwater. And I associate the submergence of these definitely man-made monuments. I just don't have patience for those who say that they're entirely a freak of nature, particularly that stone circle off Kerama, off Okinawa. I associate the submergence of these monuments with the well-documented rise in sea level that took place at the end of the last ice age. Sea level did, in fact, rise 400 feet all around the world, and submerged more than 10 million square miles of land. And we can't possibly get to grips with the mysteries of human past if we don't take these submerged areas into account. And the Black Sea, you're absolutely right, the Black Sea was a dry valley, and it was submerged during this general process of rising sea levels, when sea from the Mediterranean spilled into the formerly dry valley of the Black Sea and filled it with water.
Opelousas, Louisiana. Hey, Al, go ahead.
Yeah, good morning, George and Graham. My question is, I'd like to hear Graham's thoughts on Syria. You know, it's antiquity, and how it's going to play out in the future. You know,
what's happening in Syria right now, and the whole past of that area, right next door to Syria, of course, is Lebanon, and there we have the amazing megalithic site of Baalbek, just an extraordinary place, which I'm going to be visiting in the next few months, where we have megaliths that weigh in excess of 1,000 tons, which archaeology has attributed to the Romans. There's a Roman temple of Jupiter that stands on top of this gigantic megalithic base. And I think, as is often the case with archaeology, they give a whole site to the later culture that occupied it and don't consider the possibility that a two-phase construction has been involved there, and that we may be looking at a much earlier remnant of a lost civilization in the megalithic material, and that the Romans simply came along and built their Temple of Jupiter on top of it. And of course, that whole region, Syria, Lebanon, Turkey, is the heartland of the earliest endeavors in civilization, and as such as we know them historically today, and the earliest innovations and experimentation with agriculture, and the earliest cities. I mentioned Göbekli Tepe in Turkey in the last segment, now known to be 12,000 years old. But we have, you know, for example, in Israel Palestine, we have Jericho, where there are ancient city constructions more than 10,000 years old. So this whole area is the heart. Something happened in this whole area, I would suggest, more than 12,000 years ago, and I would, including Syria, and I would associate it with the survivors of a lost civilization attempting to restart civilization again. And it's ironic that we just have this terrible conflicts going on in this region today, where we're just, the human race just seems to be focused on, again, I have to use this phrase, hatred, fear, and suspicion, dividing us all from one another, when what is needed is love and nurture and care. And if we can only turn that corner and apply the golden principles of love, then it will be possible to end all the conflict on the earth, and perhaps really to start investigating our past and understanding who we are and where we came from.
What kind of technology, Graham, did the ancients have? I mean, you know, in some of the texts in India, they talk about the Vimanas, the flying machines. What was out there?
Fascinating. And of course, as is well known, there's an aeroplane from ancient Egypt. It's a model aeroplane, and it sits in a display case that's otherwise filled with models of birds from ancient Egyptian tombs. This particular one is clearly not a bird. It has a definite aerofoil wing structure. The wings are positioned on the top of its body, rather like a modern glider. It has an upright tail, and it was extracted from an archaeological site near the Pyramid of Saqqara, just south of Giza, and is wrongly filed under birds because archaeologists just can't get to grips with the idea that an earlier civilization might have actually mastered the power of flight. But it's true, all around the world we have traditions of flying devices like the Vimanas from ancient India, and we have just staring us in the face, you know, this intriguing evidence of the construction of gigantic monuments using just truly vast blocks of stone, and we don't really understand how all of this was done. My own feeling is that the technology of the lost civilization was in some ways similar to our own, but in other ways very, very, very different. We as a society have gone down for the last few hundred years the path of mechanical advantage. We look for mechanical solutions to problems. We don't consider the powers of the mind. And what they may do, because there are intriguing traditions, for example, from ancient Egypt and much more recently from Tibet, of the powers of the mind being used to lift and manipulate and fit together large stone artifacts. There's a particular account from ancient Egypt that talk of groups of priests standing and chanting and of huge blocks of stone being lifted into the air effortlessly without any mechanical advice. And I think that this is a very fruitful line of research, that the ancients may have had advanced psychic and mental skills which have been allowed to lapse in our civilization, that we haven't investigated this possibility enough. And there are intriguing remnants, again, from ancient Egypt, the second shrine of Tutankhamun, and an image of three initiates standing in a line with the rays of a star somehow coming down into the center of their foreheads like the third eye. You have to ask yourself what is going on there. Just because we do things in a certain way, we shouldn't imagine that it was always done that way in the past. And there are hints and remnants of psychic powers today, but we tend to pour scorn upon them and do not take them seriously. And we imagine that the only way to lift stuff is with a crane or with a leverage. But maybe there's a whole other way to do this through the powers of the mind. And maybe by rediscovering that in the past, we can also rediscover that ability in ourselves today.
Okay, Graham, we're going to come back in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to take some final phone calls with you as we talk about both your works, War God, Fingerprints of the Gods as well. Our very special guest tonight, Graham Hancock, will take the calls next on Coast to Coast AM. Well, we're going to have a classic Coast to Coast show for you on our next program with two special guests as we talk about the alien abduction files. Get ready for that. Need I say any more? When we come back in a moment with Graham Hancock, we will take final phone calls here on Coast to Coast AM as we talk about Fingerprints of the Gods and War God. Graham, how come it's going to take so long to get the Magicians of the Gods out a couple of years from now?
Well, I've already been working on this research for some time, but I'm doing a year of intensive travels and investigation to wrap all of that up. And then, I've got to write the book. So I'm aiming to finish writing the book by December of 2014. And typically it takes my publishers about 9 months to get the book into print. So we're looking at the fall of 2015 to get the book out. And I intend to do as thorough and as detailed a job on this book as I did on Fingerprints of the Gods. I think it's an extraordinary story, and it needs to be told thoroughly. And I think my background as an investigative journalist helps me to, you know, put these pieces together. I like writing nonfiction thoroughly, and I like writing fiction as well. There's one of the things I've enjoyed as I've entered my 60s is to spread my wings and to work in these two different fields, one driven powerfully by imagination and vivid recreation, and the other driven powerfully by detailed research.
Okay, back we go. Let's go to Jim in Wilmar, Minnesota, east of the Rockies. Hey, Jimmy, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Graham. First of all, I wanted to say thanks a lot for the positive influence that your work has on the world. When I hear how you talk about how we should treat each other, you know, that's just universal truth coming out right there. So thanks a lot.
Thank you for that.
And my question specifically is, I've heard a story about back in World War II, elements in the British High Command, right before, I think it was the Battle of Britain, mm-hmm. supposedly summoned the most powerful witches in England, and they performed a ritual in a forest which helped turn the tide in England's favor.
Yeah.
And could you comment on that? And then
yeah, that's absolutely,
how people in general, can, working for the forces of good, can influence the power of the war god?
That's absolutely correct. There is no doubt, and interest. There is no doubt that an attempt was made and appeared to have been successful to use, you know, good witchcraft to overcome the demonic force that was Hitler. And there's no doubt about it. I mean, just as I've shown that in my novel War God, that a demonic force was influencing the Aztecs and also influencing the Spanish, that cropped up again in the Second World War and in the rise of Hitler. I mean, this man was a demonic presence on Earth, and he certainly drew down dark supernatural forces. So it is right and proper that the forces of light should also be ranged against him. And I believe that all our battles take place not only, and I don't only mean the battles of physical warfare, but I mean our struggles as individuals, that we cannot understand them if we limit them solely to this material plane, that there are higher dimensions of ourselves that are influenced by areas of reality beyond the range of our everyday senses, and that we need to take account of these as well if we're to understand ourselves properly and to realize the impact of what we do. There's an ancient system of knowledge I spoke of earlier, Gnosticism, which sees humanity as the fulcrum of a cosmic struggle between the forces of light and the forces of darkness, and the choices that we make as the human race may have implications far beyond ourselves and our planet, and may rebound across the universe as a whole and across all of reality. So we carry a heavy responsibility to choose for the light and to work with light and with joy and with love and with goodness, because that ultimately, the force of love, is what will overcome all wickedness and evil in the world.
Okay, let's go to Anthony, Baltimore. Hey, Anthony, thanks for calling.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Yeah, I just wanted to inquire about the back when the Egyptians were around, and like say the Book of the Dead, and a lot of the stuff that they did and left behind mm-hmm. was really, really weird. And I just wanted to know if you knew anything about that.
Well, sure, I do. I've read all the various recensions of the books of the dead. The ancient Egyptian Book of the Dead is actually a later version of a much earlier scripture or liturgical text that we find in ancient Egypt. The oldest surviving versions are the so-called pyramid texts, which are inscribed in beautiful hieroglyphs in the inner chambers of pyramids of the 5th and 6th dynasty, roughly 2,200 before Christ. And then after that, we have the so-called coffin texts, so-called because they're written inside coffin lids. And then we have the books of the dead, which were inscribed on papyrus and typically buried with the mummy. And there's also another text called the Book of What is in the Duat. And all of these texts are about our mission and our purpose on earth, what we human beings are here to do, which from the ancient Egyptian point of view, our life is the precious opportunity we are given to prepare for what happens to us after death. The ancient Egyptians did not believe that life just ends when we die, but rather that the soul goes on and that it makes a journey. And that it has the opportunity to come back to the earth and live again and learn the lessons that this material plane has to teach us. So after death, we the soul makes a journey through this region, kind of parallel universe that is called the Duat. You might think of it as a netherworld or an underworld. And there we are tested and judged and weighed and measured and counted on every thought, every deed, every action, everything that we've ever done with any moment of our lives. And these ancient texts from Egypt are designed to prepare us for those tests, rather in the way that the Tibetan Book of the Dead does the same job. You know, anybody who imagines that there is no life after death may be in for a very worrying surprise if they're not prepared for what happens then. And these texts are designed to help us prepare for that and designed to encourage us to live the right life here on earth, a life where our heart, our soul, does not become heavy with sin, where we correct mistakes that we've made, and where at the end we can look back on our lives as a sculptor looks on a great work of art that he's worked on for decades, sometimes correcting mistakes, and say, well, in the end, I did good. That's what we should be able to say at the end of this life that we have on earth.
Well, let's go to first-time caller, Camille, in Charleston, West Virginia. Hi there, Camille.
Hello.
Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. I find it really interesting. And, Graham, as a researcher, I was just wondering, had you considered the sixth chapter of Genesis, where it talks about the Nephilim?
There were giants in the earth in those days when the sons of God...
Yes, well, that was... See, this is my... You see, in the 14th chapter of Isaiah, where Satan was cast down, and he was at the... You talk about the Ark of the Covenant. I believe that everything is a pattern of heaven, and especially, say, in ancient Egypt and all that, because demons have been in heaven. They have seen the glory. They have seen the Ark. It's all a pattern of what is in the heavenly realm. And so they were demons that mixed with women. Mm-hmm. And then, as you see, there were all these generations, and they lived like Methuselah, 969 years.
Yeah.
But then you come to this, and all of a sudden God is, see, so he's not going to strive with man. He's sorry that he even made man, because mm-hmm. these demons mixed, and every intent in the heart was evil.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, again, the system.
And so thus you have the flood, okay? And yeah. So there, you know, like you're talking about this destruction that was a world of the 400. You said that the Earth after the Ice Age. Well, to me, that was the flood. And you said that this is in every culture all
sure,
around.
Sure, it was. It was the flood. And if I could just respond to you here, the ancient system of knowledge that I mentioned called Gnosticism, which needs to be studied in parallel to the biblical texts, helps us to understand what's going on here. And in the Gnostic and indeed the Hermetic traditions, we find the concept of evil angels who mingle with men and who drive us to acts of recklessness and violence and cruelty. And the Gnostics also speak of entities called archons, which seek to control and misdirect the human race. And I think there's great wisdom in all of this, and I don't think we should scoff at it. I think we should take it very, very seriously and explore what it might mean, and this is exactly why it's an important theme in my novel War God, and why, in a way, whereas you cannot get into this kind of stuff in nonfiction, you can get into it imaginatively in a fictional account. And I think it's high time we took seriously these ancient texts and ancient traditions.
It is just wonderment what happened in the past, Graham, isn't it?
The past is an amazing playground of mystery, in my view. You know, I used to be a current affairs reporter. I used to be a journalist. I was the East Africa correspondent of the Economist, and I used to think that current affairs was where it's all at. But what I've discovered as the years have gone by, it's the past is where it's all at. That we know so little about our past. Really, it's a
and the past is what has made us.
And the past is what has made us. We are a product of this past, and yet a veil has been drawn over it. And here we stand in the 21st century, as we call it, uncertain of who we are, or where we came from, or what we're doing here. All of us seeking answers. All of us immersed in the great mystery and adventure of being alive. And key to that mystery and that adventure is to go through that veil into the past and discover more about ourselves and about our story and what we're really doing here. So I love the investigation of the past. I think it's an exciting and fascinating realm. And you know, perhaps in a way, it's still with us that there is. The time itself is a mystery. It operates on this material plane, but at another level, perhaps all times are interconnected. Perhaps time is more like a series of spirals that wind around one another and interconnect rather than a straight arrow between past through present into future. And that therefore what happened in the past has a living impact on what happens to us today, and all the more reason why we should understand it. And more radically, maybe it's possible even to change the past. Maybe the past is not completely written. Maybe what has not been observed can yet be changed.
Let's take our Skype caller, Sterling in Utah. Hi, Sterling. Go ahead.
Hey, George Sterling Allen here from Utah.
Oh, Sterling, one of our guests. How are you?
Yeah. Graham, could you talk to us about the interplay between ETs and humans in terms of incarnation and between life interaction and pre-birth planning and decisions about what planetary system to incarnate onto?
Well, first of all, I don't know, and I don't think any of us know exactly what ETs are. We call these entities extraterrestrials, and in a sense, they are not of this Earth. But we often make the assumption that they are simple, that it is as simple as high tech beings a bit like us who are coming here from other planets, whereas my own intuition is that these phenomena are very real. I have absolutely no doubt about the existence of these entities. What I'm not sure about is exactly what they are and whether perhaps we are in interaction with intelligences from other dimensions, other planes, other levels of reality. A shaman from the Amazon once told me that what flying saucers are vehicles for entering and leaving the spirit world. And when a shaman speaks of the spirit world, he is not so far away from a quantum physicist talking about parallel realms or parallel dimensions. So we have this phenomenon and we're projecting our own ideas upon it as to what it might be. But I think we're just surrounded by a vast mystery and we need not leap to conclusions, but rather explore further what is going on here. And that's why I'm particularly interested in the consciousness issues relating to the ET phenomenon, that often in deeply altered states of consciousness, we can contact these entities and have interaction with them and have experiences with them, which are beyond the realm of the physical. And I don't think we'll ever get to grips with the whole ET mystery and this whole issue of genetic interface with ETs without exploring the realms of consciousness as well as the physical realms.
Let's go to Los Angeles. Christian's turn on Coast to Coast. Hi, Christian. Go ahead.
Hi, guys. Hello, Graham. It's interesting how you were mentioning about the event, the eye that happened about 12,000, 9,000 years ago. I live right across from the tar pits, and I've done a lot of, like, excavation work, you know, volunteering about a decade ago. Mm-hmm. And we always used to ask ourselves, what caused the extinction of the megafauna?
Yeah.
And our theory was essentially over-hunting and overpopulation of man spreading out But you think this is interesting. I haven't heard this before, that it actually may have been that comet that whacked into the Earth.
Yeah.
And was such a catastrophe. Do you think when that happened, do you think that's probably what destroyed Atlantis and essentially the Egyptians and the Mayans and the Aztecs and the Incas essentially were the survivors?
Yeah, absolutely. You've hit the nail on the head. I think that the Atlantis story is very real. It's based on real events. It's a memory of what happened to the Earth 12,900 years ago. It's a memory of the gigantic cataclysm that struck the Earth that was instrumental in the extinction of the megafauna. I don't think that overhunting by humans was the cause of that, although, of course, I've heard that theory and I'm familiar with it. There's just no doubt the evidence is global, it's worldwide, that we passed through a cataclysmic episode between 13,000 and 12,000 years ago, and that there was this massive deep freeze and die-off of animals, and undoubtedly this was the most likely time when we could have lost a whole episode of our story and become a species with amnesia.
Graham, get your website out one more time for us.
Okay, so that's grahamhancock.com. And my special offer on my novel War God and my absolute willingness to respond to emails that are sent to the special email address on the War God page and to send signed, dedicated labels to go on the title page of the book are there. And I do appeal to my friends in the coast-to-coast audience. Help me make this book a hit in Britain. It's not too difficult to register an account with Amazon UK. Just takes a couple of minutes. And we'll see the book being picked up by an American publisher.
All right, my friend. Always a pleasure. Graham Hancock. For Dan Galante, Gina Salvati, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasor, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, George Knapp, John B. Wells, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.